Would you mind just like pulling up my book and saying,
yeah, he's the author. Here we go.
Here we go.
Broadcast live with the man with his book.
Awesome.
Dr. Evan Osar. We're going to talk about some hip mobility today. And I'm going to back up in a second so you can see actually the giant, got the echo too. Giant lump on my head. Got elbowed at soccer. So don't mind that. Not sure if you can see the yellow bruising as well. Kind of spreading out from it, but that's okay. So we're going to talk today about a bunch of hip mobility stuff. Dr. Osar is one of the world-class experts in movement dysfunction, corrective exercise, all that kind of stuff. And a lot of people have hips that don't do what they want them to, right? That squatting, we get this kind of pinching feeling in the front of the hip, trying to deadlift. It's like, oh, I can't keep my back straight. I'm rounding a bunch. My hamstrings are super tight. And people recognize that hip mobility is a potential issue for them. But there's a lot of, let's call it misconceptions, and then just kind of, you know, simple generic advice that isn't very helpful out there. And in this case, where we get to do a webinar, where we get to go a little bit deeper and actually dive into some topics like this, we're going to try to give you guys some stuff that's not just sort of a, hey, here's five quick tips for, you know, whatever, stretch your hamstrings, like try this. You know, it's going to be a little bit more complicated in terms of understanding the actual dynamics of what's going on here. So that, you know, you actually have a framework that's helpful for understanding how and why your hips might not be doing what they're supposed to. So with that, let's talk about common causes. What's going on? I'm going to adjust this just a little bit as well, just so
we're both. Yeah, so what we're going to cover tonight, Todd, is common causes of really hip impingement, because that's essentially what a lot of you may be experiencing, what a lot of the patients that we see are experiencing. And that's kind of that pain right in the front of the hip when you do any kind of flexion-based exercise, squat, even some deadlifts and things like that. And then hamstring tightness, you know, is it really hamstring tightness and what's going on? And some of the, like I said, some of the overlooked causes of hip issues. So my background basically is I'm a chiropractic physician, but really what I specialize is in movement and really understanding some of these things that, as Todd was referring to, understanding why people have issues and, you know, looking at some of the common causes, obviously, but then some of the uncommon causes. So as we turn our attention to these hip type issues, one of the most common things that we see is it's the alignment and control of not just the pelvis, not just the lumbar spine, not just the hip complex, but really how your thorax stacks on top of your pelvis. Because if we think about your thorax on top of your pelvis, what we refer to as a core, it basically comes from the top, the first rib, which is right here behind your collarbone. So if you put your hands on your collarbone and go straight back, that's your first rib. Now it comes all the way down to your ischial tuberosities. That's basically the bottom of your pelvis. This is essentially our core. So you want your core in the best alignment possible, so that that's essentially your foundation for what you're lifting off. Then your hip is really just an extremity that's moving, the ball's moving around the socket as your cylinder. We call it the thoracopelvic cylinder, is because it's basically forming a cylinder, the rib cage on top of the pelvis. And the whole cylinder is going to move over top the femoral head or the hip joint, the ball of the ball and socket joint. So if you understand that sort of premise, then all your patterns essentially get set up off of that, because your squat pattern is basically you're just now hinging over top of your femoral heads. You know, maybe you're a little bit more upright. Your deadlift is essentially the same thing. You're hinging over top your femoral heads, but your cylinder staying stable the entire time. Now, the first thing, one common cause, overlooked cause, I should say, common overlooked cause, is when individuals are not aligning and controlling this thoracopelvic cylinder or their core, and they're compromising then their lumbar spine. And I'll show you a couple examples of what I mean by that. Now, one of the things that we were always trying to do in our industry is get more thoracic extension. However, for the sedentary population, that is actually a really big issue. And when I say sedentary, it's really a sedentary older population. So if you're an older athlete, when I say older is relative, you know, it's relative to, you know, I'm 50, you know,
age is just a number.
Age is just a number. I'm talking like your 60-year-old client that may come to you if you're a coach and they're very kyphotic, then yeah, they're going to need to work on thoracic extension. That's a real obvious cause. But for the almost every athlete that you see, you've referred to me that I've seen that does CrossFit, coaches are the same, is they're too extended. You've actually worked so much and so hard and so well, you've done a really good job on creating so much hyperextension of the thoracic spine that serves you in lifting. But the problem is you get too locked in extension. So what happens is the more you get locked in extension, you'll quickly run out of range of motion as you're going down to your squat or deadlift because your spine has to move at some point, or it's required to maintain curvatures that'll start to move out of that range. Unless you get a curve from your low back, from your lumbar spine, all the way up through your thorax, it's going to be hard to maintain that curvature all the way down through your movement. So what happens is these individuals that get overextended in their thorax, they'll go very early into posterior pelvic tilt, or I hate the term butt wink, but that's what the industry calls it. So, but really it's that posterior pelvic tilt. So I'm going to put the screen down just for a moment. So what happens is the more extended you get through the thorax, you're going to run out of range of motion very early and go into posterior pelvic tilt. So your thorax still stays upright, but you're in posterior pelvic tilt for a big portion of the movement pattern. The challenge with that is you're going into posterior pelvic tilt and lumbar spine flexion. Your lumbar spine starts to flex. So that starts to overload your lumbar spine in not a great position. And that's really what starts to tighten things up, because now you're irritating the nerves, the discs and the nerves coming out of your low back. And there's no science around this. It's just something I've seen over and over and over again. You're going to get tight around your hip complex because it's trying to stop all this compressive force that's going down through your lumbar spine because you're not respecting that the more neutral alignment. And I'll just back up just for a moment. When you squat, your pelvis should start out in an anterior pelvic tilt, or the first motion as you go into your hinge position should be an anterior rotation of the pelvis or the entire cylinder. And it should stay relatively anterior for a good portion of the movement until you run out of range of motion of your hip flexion. Then you'll start to go slightly into posterior pelvic tilt if you're going into a deep squat or a snatch or something like that, clean position.
Here, I'll back this up a little bit too, so we can have a bit more, so we can hopefully see more of what we're doing. But yeah, I think that, so let me ask just one clarifying question, because I think that one thing you were touching on that's really important is this idea of overextension of the upper back.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, as you mentioned, conventional wisdom is that I have a hard time putting my arms over my head.
Yep.
I struggle with anything with my upper body. What am I missing? Oh, I'm missing thoracic extension.
I need to
work on it. And when someone realizes that maybe they're missing thoracic extension, and then they potentially try to extend their upper back,
correct,
they can't.
Correct.
So they're like, oh man, I am definitely missing thoracic extension.
Correct.
So I just need to get even more extended.
Right.
Something else is actually going on. Can you kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah.
I think that's a really key point for people.
For sure. Because as I said, like a lot of the younger, you know, I say again, younger just being relative, like 20 to 30 year old CrossFit coaches and athletes, they've worked so much on thoracic extension. A lot of the limitations in overhead motion isn't because of lack of thoracic extension. Now, of course, if you've done your assessment, and your client is kyphotic, that's obviously the issue. But for a lot of clients that are lacking range of motion in overhead range of motion, it's really their lats. And then because you do so much pulling exercises, your lats get super strong and super short and tight. So the lat is really what starts to pull the shoulder back down, so you limit range of motion. However, if you're not assessing that specifically, then what starts to happen is like, it's thoracic mobility. So you just keep driving thoracic mobility. So the thorax really starts to become too extended. And if you look at your client from the side, you're seeing the thorax way behind the pelvis versus stacked over top of the pelvis actually where it should be.
Yeah.
So I would look at shoulder mobility and really evaluate shoulder mobility to look at where is their rib cage, relatively speaking, to their pelvis, and are they getting pure shoulder flexion, or are they actually compensated by hyperextended? Or another common thing, even though it's not a shoulder course, we can talk about this another time, is what a lot of CrossFit athletes have done, and this is a lot of heavy lifters, and this is just a common pattern I've seen that nobody really talks about, is they've hypermobilized their scapula off the ribcage. So what happens is you run out of range of motion with your lats. So what you actually do is you start getting hypermobile and your scapula starts coming out here off the ribcage. So you get range of motion, but the problem is your shoulder's not stable because your scapula is off the ribcage. If you actually put the scapula back on the ribcage, now you'll see the range of motion is more like this and not there where it actually looks like it is. Yeah. So to answer your question, I think a lot of shoulder mobility issues are lat type of issues and teres like underneath here. And you know, we've worked on that quite a bit ourselves, is tightness there, not so much thoracic mobility issues.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and I think that what's tricky for people is they feel like their thoracic spine is stuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it kind of is, because it's already at end range extension.
That's exactly right.
And you're
exactly.
like, okay, yeah, you need to get more extension. And they can't because
you've already exhausted the range of extension.
So they
yes.
feel restricted in
that's
extension.
Right. That's right.
And
that's
they
right.
are because they're existing in a state of
almost end range extension just all the time.
All the time. Exactly. And that's a huge point. And I don't know if anybody actually ever talks about that. It's like, yeah, you're already end range extension.
Yeah.
And then what you start to do is you just start to drive the thorax further back this way, which makes your pelvis go further that way, which is not a good position, again, to load your spine or your pelvis.
Yeah.
Because, again, you're not respecting the alignment of the cylinder.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So that excessive extension through the upper back, like you mentioned, which is, again, a little bit confusing, can actually cause rounding of the lower back.
Exactly.
As you attempt to create hip flexion.
Correct.
Because
Correct.
You've already locked yourself in position.
Correct.
And you have no more ability to kind of articulate as you drop down.
Right. That's exactly
so
right.
The only thing you can do is just round through the lumbar.
That's exactly, you said it better than I did. But that's exactly what it is. Because if you look at the great Olympic lifters, what you'll see is they're extended, but they get, it's more like a lengthening. It's like they're going this way, not this way. So they're not going this way as they go down their squat. They're actually going this way, lengthening. So they're going into slight posterior pelvic tilt as they're going into their squat or clean, whatever position, catch position. But what they're actually doing is they're keeping that length. They're not going into that fast and hard posterior pelvic tilting and completely reversing that lumbar spine curve, which they're overloading the spine because they're so in range. They're not in range through their thorax. Yeah. And that's a great distinction that you clarified.
Yeah. And I think some of those people too are also just very gifted anatomically in terms
exactly.
of the way that their hip joint is structured
exactly.
and all that kind of, and their relative limb length.
That's exactly
and
right.
And so, you know, they're more resilient
exactly.
and they have just better bony structure to create those positions
Correct.
Too.
Absolutely.
So even if they are faulting too much into extension, it's like,
right,
well,
right.
they have more than enough capacity to buffer that. So
Correct.
Correct.
Right. Right. You know, and we always talk about like, there's people that are just meant to lift weights and there's people that are meant to run fast. You know, like you look at a Kenyan, they're just meant to run fast. I mean, their bodies are designed to run fast and they're great athletes at that. You know, some people are meant to do, you know, CrossFit and some people's bodies aren't as able to do it or do it as well. But again, everybody can improve if they understand some of these basic ideas. Yeah,
sure.
Yep.
Okay,
awesome.
So I kind of interrupted you. You were talking about this concept of excessive extension through the upper back,
yeah.
putting people in a position to not be able to properly rotate the pelvis as they create hip flexion.
Correct.
Then
correct.
Resulting in lumbar faulting.
Correct, correct.
As one of our causes of this
yeah, correct.
Impingy difficulty
correct.
In squatting,
correct.
Et cetera.
Correct.
What are the next things? What else is
yeah.
what else is going wrong?
So I'm gonna use that. So we'll say, okay, one of the most common overlooked causes is that we'll say lumbar spine. I don't even write it, let's just say it. Thoracic extension and lumbar spine flexion. Okay. So a spinal driven issue. Now your spinal driven issue, I'll just put spine here. Okay, spine and also to do with the pelvis, but that is also what creates a lot of what we found to create a lot of hamstring shortness. So that way, when you're doing a pulling pattern, like a deadlift or whatever kind of pulling pattern you're doing, it's like, oh, my hamstrings are tight. I can't get that anterior pelvic rotation that I need. But a lot of it is being driven because of this very cause that we talked about with the spinal positions. Now, one of the most important things you can do to help you evaluate whether it's a spine related issue or just pure hamstring tightness. And in your younger people, your younger population, your younger lifters, it's probably more spinal related issue than true hamstring shortness. Cause they just haven't done, they're too young to have real adaptive shortening of their hamstrings. The younger kids we're seeing like high school kids. They have real short, like developmentally short hamstrings because of how they developed as toddlers. But we'll leave them out of the equation. Your older clients, if you're dealing with people 60, 70, they may have adaptive shortening of their hamstrings. Most of us in the 20 to, you know, 50, 60 range, we have more issues being driven by our spine. Because what happens is, I don't really know why this happens, but what happens is again, the more you stress the lumbar spine, the more you get adaptive shortening around the hip complex. And I've seen this a lot with my people that have had surgical procedures on their low back, discectomies, laminectomies. The ones that have laminectomies, they end up with the worst issues, but they all end up with really short hamstrings, really short hip rotators, and they have a lot of myofascial gripping around the posterior hip complex, the hamstrings. So that's why I believe that it's a neurological driven issue of why so many people have hip issues. Now, the second issue is how people are doing hip mobility, which is related to this issue as well. And we were just talking right before we started about some hip mobility drills, and this is not a knock on anybody's hip mobility drills. But what happens is once you have short hamstrings and short hip rotators, we'll say the hip external rotators, even the glutes to a certain extent get real short and tight because you start compromising the spine. Well, now you start to go into, I'm going to actually just drop this down a little bit. Now you start to go into your hip mobility drill. So you go into like, say, what would you call it?
The hip controlled articular rotation. So hip cars.
So then you're going to your hip cars. But what happens is you're already getting impingement. You're already creating a posterior pelvic rotation. And the more you go through your hip range of motion, the more you're driving your lumbar spine. So if you actually even do this on yourself, find your low back, put your hands on your low back so you feel your lumbar spine. You should have a relatively gentle lordotic curve. Now you bring your hip up and you probably don't have to go very far and already your spine is starting to flex. Now you're doing all your hip mobility in a flexed spine position. So you've never taught your brain, your nervous system, how to get neutral and control neutral and work within a range that actually you can control neutral, which is what you need to do when you get into a deep lift, right? Yeah. So what's happening is you're mobilizing your hip, but at the same time, you're hypermobilizing your low back. And the more you hypermobilize your low back, the more it's going back to create hip tightness. Not right there. Not right then and there, because you're mobilizing your hips, so you're getting more hip mobility in the short term, but you've actually hypermobilized your low back. Now your low back is actually more vulnerable as you go back to your lifts. So what you want to make sure you do is when you're doing your hip mobility work, really focus on creating hip mobility that spares the spine, that really allows you to get hip mobility and do all those great drills that you're doing, but doesn't change the lumbar spine position, because that's ultimately what you need to do when you lift. You don't want the lumbar spine moving. You want the hips moving, not the lumbar spine. And I think too many people are working on hip mobility and not respecting the position of the lumbar spine. So therefore, they're actually creating a very problem that they're trying to address.
Because I think that one of the things that happens with people with hip mobility issues is that they essentially, that this whole area from sort of their navel to their knee is kind of a black box.
Yeah, they can't
tell,
yeah,
are you moving your hip or are you moving your back?
Yeah,
and it's correct. Kind of, okay, well, it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg situation, correct, as to where the mobility issue came from, but something is wrong,
that's
and
right,
they can't tell the difference between,
right,
hip movement and back movement.
Correct.
And then potentially some drills that they're doing to work on this are not necessarily going well,
correct,
because they can't tell the difference in the first place.
Correct. So let me just give you a quick example, just because we were talking about this earlier, like the pigeon stretch. Is this a sturdy bench right here?
Sturdy enough, probably.
Okay,
find out. Maybe we'll have a blooper.
So
we get a blooper.
Like when most people are doing the pigeon stretch down on the floor, they're already in spinal flexion. They're already in spinal flexion. So even though they're getting a hip mobility, they're doing it again with spinal flexion. So they're actually not going to respect the alignment of the lumbar spine and actually train the hip to be mobile relative to the lumbar spine. So what we do with our athletes, we just have them put their leg up on a bench. So that way, exactly to your point, Todd, their goal is, as they're on this bench, is to keep their spine neutral and then do the same sort of mobility work, but keep that spine neutral. So that way, all their mobility is getting it here at their hip, which is basically the end position of your lifts that you want, and still respect the alignment of your thoracopelvic cylinder, the core, and keeping that pelvis and that lumbar spine neutral. And again, you can work towards more of that internal rotation position, but a lot of people will begin the impingement. So stay more externally rotated, so pelvis away from the forward leg, and keep working towards getting the hip further this direction, and work on tilting the pelvis this direction, because that's the direction you need the pelvis to go to get that release back here and not change the lumbar spine. And actually, like I said, really respect the position of the lumbar spine. And the next point, the next sort of idea based around that as well, is also hamstring mobility, which is also really more of a hip mobility kind of drill too. And I'll get down on the floor again. I would use a strap for this. There we go. And basically what you do is you put the strap around your foot, and you want, again, make sure you keep that lumbar spine. Can you see? So the lumbar spine and pelvis stay neutral. So the pelvis and hips stay down on the floor. You bring the strap around your foot. Just work in this range. You can work in this range over here. But really the range you want to work in, the direction you want to go, is that way. Because this is where you need to get the release, on the outside of the hip. So you want the leg to go that direction without the pelvis coming up off the floor. You keep the pelvis down. You keep the spine and cylinder neutral, the lumbar spine neutral. You go as far as you can. And what we do is just do a contract, relax in this position. So we'll contract down into the strap this way, like this. isometric contraction for about 5 seconds, and then release, send the heel towards the ceiling while keeping the hip and pelvis down on the floor. The lumbar spine stays neutral. So do a series of 5 to 10 repetitions, contract, relax. So that way you're getting that release in the back side of the hip here and that lateral hamstring, which is really what you need to release to get that pelvis to ultimately come into that anterior rotation that you want for all your lifts, especially your deadlift type patterns. And that's how you basically, you deal with the spine issue, you deal with your hip and mobility issue, and you also deal with that hamstring tightness, because it's not really hamstring tightness, or it's more of a neurological driven tightness. It's almost like your nervous system is in protective mode. So it's not true like hamstring shortness, like you need to myofascially release it. You need to keep the spine more neutral and then work on releasing the posterior hip complex and lengthening out the tissues, the myofascial tissues through the back of the leg.
Yeah. So how can someone tell if they have actual tight hamstrings versus just the feeling of tight hamstrings because everything else is kind of screwed up?
Yeah. People always ask me that question. I don't have a great answer without assessing the person myself. But here's one simple way you could probably tell is if you're, we'll just say you're a 30-year-old coach, you're on the floor, your legs are straight, bring your leg up and see how far you can get it up without changing your lumbar spine. So my leg, if I do this, I can get my leg up to about there, okay? Other leg comes up to about there. So about, I don't know, 60 degrees, 70 degrees. You want to have at least that, but probably more if you're a male. As a lifter, you're probably not going to have that much. But what you're going to start to see, let me jump back down here. You're going to see a couple of things if it's a neurological issue. You're going to go really early. You're going to feel, if you put your hand underneath your low back, you'll feel the lumbar spine flatten or the head go into extension like that. So bring the chin down. And then bring the leg up, because what you're seeing is that neurological tension through your nervous system. And as you pull that nerve tight, basically the sciatic nerve, but the sciatic nerve through the dura, through the nervous system all the way into your brain, you'll start to see the person go into extension, or their lumbar spine will flex really early. And they'll go into one of these positions, the shoulders will come up because you're stretching out the nervous system. So that's probably the easiest assessment to look at to see, do you truly have neurological shortness or just pure hamstring tautness, that's the hamstrings are just overcontracted and or just need to be some myofascial release through the hamstrings. So do the straight leg raise test, feel or look at the lumbar spine. Does it move? How early does it move? Like I said, you should probably get a healthy individual. A female is going to get a lot more. Lifters will generally have less just because they just generally have less range of motion. But you should get, at least as a lifter, you should get a healthy lifter with healthy hips. You should easily get 45, probably closer to 70 to 90, but let's just say somewhere between 45 to 70 degrees. And it should be relatively symmetrical. You don't want to see like one leg come up here before the lumbar spine flexes and the other leg like this. So if you see a big difference, discrepancy from side to side, focus on the tighter side, because it's also the asymmetries that will jack people up. Because if you have one side that's really short and tight, you can have a sensation of like my hamstrings are just short and tight. But it's because as you go down with one tight hamstring or one tight posterior hip complex, you'll get rotation. And that will, again, rotate your spine and create a lot of torque and tension and just give you this general sense of like my hamstrings are tight, but it's not both sides that need to be released equally. Focus on the tighter side. Spend more time on the tighter, shorter side.
Yeah. So another question, because sometimes this will happen where someone will feel like their hamstrings are very tight. They'll lay down and do that, and they're like, flies up.
Yeah, a ton of range of motion.
So what's going on with that individual?
I think usually one of two things. One is they're not being sensitive enough to where their low back is moving. Their low back is so flexible, kind of like that end range extension. I don't have thoracic extension because you're so extended. I think it's the same thing. You have so much spinal flexion that you're not even aware of like when you're actually running out of range of motion. So sometimes you need somebody to help you sort of evaluate on you. I think the second thing is people, again, it's the same idea with that thoracic extension. They have so much hamstring length that they actually feel a lot of tension because they're always at end range hamstring length. So their hamstrings actually may be a little too long, even though they just may not use them well functionally. They may have really great hamstring length, but once they start loading up, they're probably changing something about their spine that's not allowing them to use that range of motion. So if you find like, hey, you know what? I got awesome hamstring length, but then when I go to deadlift or something, I can't use that range. It's probably because there's something here that's not allowing you to be stable enough. So your body's like, I'm done. It'll lock you up out of that available range, being able to use that available range of motion. And in those cases, I would just work on making sure, you know, breathing drills, some of your core stability drills, and then just with body weight, make sure that you're creating a hinge pattern and really feeling your lumbar spine, feeling your pelvis move, that you're not creating that motion that you ultimately don't want.
Yeah. And I think you started to touch on it, that for some of those folks, the movement that they're trying to go into just creates a massive threat response, which just tightens them up.
Exactly.
So you have the range in this, yes, which is non-threatening to you.
Correct.
But for some reason, bilateral standing hinge just is something that's
correct.
Scares you on a subconscious level.
That's right. No,
I can't do it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that's the same thing. Like I said, that's where I think a lot of hamstring shortness, tightness is really just, it's a threat response. It's just shortening down. So you just don't go into that range, but then we just try to force those ranges. And then it really just keeps shortening down the range. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
Great. So we have this concept of excessive extension creating spinal faulting.
Mm-hmm.
We have this concept of improper pelvic control creating this feeling of tight hamstrings, which may or may not be true.
Correct.
Some cases people do have tight hamstrings.
Yeah, for sure. Don't.
What else? What else is giving people trouble with their hips?
Yeah. I think the last thing that we'll touch upon, because all these things are sort of, they're all interrelated, because a lot of clients are, they're coming in, athletes are coming in, they have all these issues combined. The last thing is, if we think about the hip joint, this is sort of a controversial point because there's so many people that aren't saying this. So, but again, that's why we're here to talk about this. If you think about the ball and socket joint, the ball should relatively be centered in the socket through almost all activities. Of course, it'll never be perfectly centered all the time, but let's just say for simplicity's sake, it should be relatively well centered. So whether you're in the loading position of a deadlift or the final position, it should be relatively well centered. So you want the pelvis moving over top of that femoral head. Now, what happens in our industry, again, there could be a little room for error on this, but as you come up from these positions, what our industry has taught us is you need to squeeze as tightly as you possibly can. And under certain loads, that's 100% absolutely true, because you gotta contract everything you possibly can to move the load and protect your spine and your hip joints, okay? But even under massive loads, you should still stay relatively centered. You will have more overall contraction around the joint, but you don't want to run into a situation where you're driving that femoral head so far forward in the acetabulum, the ball forward in the socket. Because what's happening for a lot of athletes is they're coming up and they're driving so hard that they're driving their thorax. You can see like what happens. I drive my thorax back, my pelvis goes forward into posterior tilt, and then I drive that femoral head forward within the acetabulum. You could probably deal with that. That's not a great thing, but you could probably deal with it if you actually got out of that position. If you actually went home and relaxed your hip back to its more resting position, you could probably deal with the lifts where you drive it forward. Still not great for the hip, but you could live with it. The problem is a lot of athletes in a lot of our society, they're not releasing out of it. So they're driving this position because they're using so much load and repetition and volume that they're actually living now with that femoral head impinged forward. Hence the reason why they're getting hip impingement, that because it's a ball too far forward, and now you're starting to jam it up against the front side of the socket. So now when you go to sit down, you're like, oh yeah, I'm getting that little pinchy feeling, and you may even develop some bone spurs, and that's what FAI, or femoral acetabular impingement, is all about. And it's because not only are you banging it during the lifts, but then you're living your life like that. And that's why it's so important to get that hip mobility. You should almost work just as much on your hip mobility at the end of your workout as you do in the beginning of the workout. So that way you're leaving your session with your hip nice and mobile. Otherwise, because what happens typically is you mobilize to get ready for the lift, you go lift, and then you go home because you're tired. You're just like, all right, I'm done. I'm shot. I'm going home. But neurologically, you're all fired up. Even though you're shot, neurologically, your body's like, again, that defense mode, that reactive mode, is like, I'm going to keep all this tight because that's what you trained me to do. So that way you're going home. Now you're sitting on your couch at home and your hip is way far forward. And now that starts shortening down from a neurological standpoint, those fibers, it keeps it contracted, I should say. And that's what creates that hip impingement and makes it so hard for people to maintain hip mobility, because they know how to, you know, you know how to create hip mobility. Everybody knows how to create it. It's the ability to maintain it. So it's the ability to like let it go. Let from a, you know, you have to consciously start relaxing your butt. Like when you're standing around, you know, at work, or you're doing your dishes at home, they should just feel your hips. They should not feel contracted. They should be relaxed and soft. Like all muscles should be relaxed and relatively soft at rest. But again, a lot of athletes will come in and as soon as I feel their hips, I mean, just rock hard, solid. They haven't done a good enough job teaching them their nervous system how to let go of muscles. And it's not mobilization. Mobilization is actually actively like moving joints, you know, the joint itself. It's from a neurological standpoint, saying to your nervous system, let go of these muscles, let them go. You're not under threat right now. Relax it. So that it seems too simple to be effective, but that's one of the most important strategies we have to teach our athletes and our general patients as well, is like, stop gripping your hips. It's so easy. It's such a, especially the hips, especially for people that have had low back trauma, abdominal distress, you know, pelvic floor issues. The glutes are, and hip rotators are a very powerful way to help protect this whole area here. So it's also, there's that whole fear and protection mechanism that's built into that contraction as well. So if you just consciously help yourself, just, you know, hey, I'm done training. Let these hip muscles go. Let my butt just be relaxed. It's all good. You're not losing any strength. You're not losing any power. You're not losing any shape of your glutes. So just trust that that's a very powerful strategy to stop a lot of this hip impingement and maintain the hip mobility that you work so hard on getting.
Yeah. So I think there's a few things there that you brought up that I wanted to touch on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this concept of almost excessive hip extension.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So a lot of people are cued to extend their hip, which, you know, for a lot of training purposes is important, right? You
want to extend the hip
on a clean, you want to extend the hip like you demonstrate at the end of a deadlift, et cetera.
Yeah.
But there is a point past which you're just really driving.
Correct.
Excessively. So how can someone tell the difference between, okay, this is the hip extension that I want versus now I'm getting to the point where I'm actually sort of shoving my femur out of my pelvis because I'm just trying to drive so much extension.
Yeah. You can't do it, or you sort of assess it, you know, more in a static position like this, because you can watch it on a lift. You can see like where, again, if you watch your good lifters, when they extend up, just go through the motion of a clean.
Yeah, sure. So here.
So yeah. So at this point, what Todd should be doing is he should still have the ball relatively maintained in the socket, but he's lengthening this way. He shouldn't be coming go that way. Exactly. That's how you know that you're driving your pelvis too far anteriorly and not anterior rotation, but anteriorly, like on this frontal plane. Yeah. This horizontal plane, I should say, versus you want to come this way into extension, that way vertically into extension, not through the horizontal plane. That's the biggest thing that your coach, if you're a coach, watch your athletes for that. If you're an athlete, have your coach watch that, or just, you can just record it on your phone and say, hey, do I come up from my lift, or is my pelvis actually coming forward of where my thorax is? You always want the cylinder stacked, even though it's lengthening. You want the cylinder relatively stacked. And if you just Google, who's a great powerlifter, Chad?
Chad Vaughn.
Yeah, Chad Vaughn. If you go watch Chad Vaughn, I mean, he's textbook. You'll see like his cylinder stays completely stacked as he's coming up with the lift.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Great. Yeah. Yeah.
And then something else, just with this idea of the femoral head kind of coming out of the acetabulum.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about excessive extension earlier.
Yeah.
So if someone is sort of defaulting into extension all the time, what is happening to their pelvis relative to that femoral head, right? My thought process would be that if they're driving extension constantly, that then they're going to be in a position where they're potentially almost rotating the pelvis and almost kind of pulling it apart such that then the femoral head is jammed all the way forward and then just at default.
Exactly. And that's where most CrossFit athletes, and again, this is most heavy lifters are all the same. They're actually in posterior pelvic tilt. Now, the reason why they look so anterior, there's a couple of reasons. And because we're going down another rabbit hole, is we've all been taught. I got taught from day one of rehab 20 years ago or 25 years ago that everybody's in an anterior pelvic tilt. First of all, you want to be in an anterior pelvic tilt, or you want to be able to get into anterior pelvic tilt. That's really not the problem. Even though everybody's made it a problem, that's not the problem. The problem is getting yourself into anterior pelvic, the lack of being able to get yourself into anterior pelvic tilt to load your pelvis and hip complex appropriately. most people are in posterior pelvic tilt because number one, we learned that. So everybody's driven their hips into posterior pelvic tilt by over squeezing their glutes. But the bigger challenge is, like I said, not releasing here enough to get the pelvis to go anterior. So that way, when you're loading up into your lifts, you can actually come up into and use your glutes appropriately in that extension position. So most people are living in posterior pelvic tilt because they're squeezing and then because they've trained that pattern into their body so much because of all the, and again, it really came from Yanda. Yanda was, you know, the first person that really came up with lower cross syndrome. And he was brilliant. Don't get me wrong. He influenced me a lot. I got to see him before he passed away. And he was brilliant about his whole, you know, muscle imbalances concept. But remember who, I don't know if you remember, but Yanda worked primarily back in the 60s and 70s and 80s when he was developing these strategies. And he worked primarily with blue-collar workers. Blue-collar workers that are working outside, much different than our white-collar workers that are working at desks, which is basically everybody that we're coaching up these days. Everybody's sitting at a desk. They're not sitting in anterior pelvic tilt. They're sitting in posterior pelvic tilt. So they're coming in that bias in posterior pelvic tilt. So if we're coaching them more into posterior pelvic tilt, now we're really teaching them how to, like, never get out of that position. And that's, again, leads to that hip impingement, the hamstring tightness, because they're never coming out of that position throughout their day. Because again, it wouldn't be a big deal if you're driving them into posterior pelvic tilt if they came out of it at the end of the session and throughout the rest of their life. But again, they're not. They're going back and sitting in posterior pelvic tilt. They go to their job. Even if they have a standing desk, they stand in posterior pelvic tilt with their thorax behind their pelvis. So it's you can kind of see how this myth has perpetuated through our industry. So yeah, you want to teach people hip extension, but hip extension coming this direction, or if you're doing hip extending because you're driving a sled forward, but not hip extension by doing this right here, by driving the pelvis forward over top the hip joints.
Yeah, sure. So we talked a little bit about posterior tilt, anterior tilt, all that kind of stuff. So in the dynamics of, let's say, let's start with a hinging movement.
Yeah.
What do we actually want the pelvis to be doing as far as the tilting type of
motion? Yeah. The one thing we teach in all our certification courses, it's really not about the position where your pelvis starts. So even if you live in posterior pelvic tilt, that's not great, but I'm not worried about that. If when you go into your patterning, you can actually get anterior pelvic rotation, because that's what you need to posteriorly to load your posterior hip complex. The problem is that when you live posteriorly, you can't get anterior pelvic rotation. So that's why people feel, oh, I have amnesic glutes or weak glutes. It's not because you have weak glutes. It's because you never got them lengthened out to that anterior pelvic rotation to actually load your glutes. Because like, we just had a girl that came through our course. She's like, I could never feel my glutes, but I just taught her this very thing. Get your pelvis to go anteriorly, focus more on the eccentric phase of your exercise pattern. And she's like, oh my God, I finally feel my glutes working. It's the ability to lengthen a muscle, which ultimately, you know, allows it to contract fully. But we focus in our industry so much on the concentric, like just focus on the concentric phase, that we've forgotten that it's actually the eccentric phase, that anterior pelvic rotation that starts to load, whether you're doing a squat, whether you're doing a swing, it's all the same thing. It's the ability to get pelvis to go anteriorly that loads the glutes, that loads the hamstrings, the posterior hip rotators appropriately.
So how do you get someone to learn to create that proper tilting position? Because a lot of people who struggle with that are just going to arch their low back even more trying to find it.
That's exactly what they do. So we use a couple of different patterns. The first thing is getting back to here, get the hamstrings released. When I say hamstrings, it's really you're just getting some of that neural tension out, but you're also getting the ability to keep that pelvis back in, or the hip back in the socket as they lengthen their leg. Then it's hands on the pelvis. So we will oftentimes, I'll just use this have them put the pelvis against the wall. And what I say to them is they step maybe a foot or 2 feet, probably a foot, hands on the pelvis. And I really want you to focus on moving your entire cylinder. I'll go to the side first. Move your entire cylinder and slide your hips up the wall. So they feel their pelvis moving up the wall, and then they'll stop when they no longer feel movement underneath their hands. Because what a lot of clients will do is they'll keep going, and I'm like, did you notice your pelvis is no longer moving? So rotate. And then once you feel the stoppage of the rotation, don't keep going, because that's what a lot of clients are doing. They're like, oh, I feel this all in my low back, because you flexed your spine more than you flexed your pelvis and your hips. So hands on the pelvis so you feel the amount of motion you have. And then I was just stay here and then breathe in this position. Focus on actively trying to lift that tailbone up. And some clients will say, oh, I feel this in my back, because what they're trying to do is arch their back. Keep the cylinder stacked. lengthen here, breathe, try to get your spine long that direction, keep the spinal curvature, and just focus on lifting the entire pelvis that direction. So up towards the ceiling, not changing the lumbar spine curvature. Yeah. So that's a good way to have your clients train that. And that's what we use as part of some of our functional warm-ups for our clients. Once we've done that hamstring release, once we've done our myofascial work as well.
Yeah, so they're essentially using the cue of you should feel your hips sliding up the wall.
Up the wall, yeah. Yep.
Because if the hip is moving, well, if they feel their butt sliding up the wall, then most likely they're actually moving through the hip. And once that stops moving, but they continue to move, okay, where's it coming from? Somewhere in their back.
Exactly.
Okay. Great.
Got it.
So other question, mm-hmm. which we've touched on this a little bit, and I think it's kind of another thing that's complicated but very common, and especially in this hinging pattern, is we get people who are simultaneously overextending through parts of their back and then rounding through others. And it's a very messy situation, right? They're not getting the pelvis to move properly. They've locked up part of their back into extension.
Yeah,
they sort of run out of range of motion.
Yeah.
And then one part faults into flexion, but everything else is extended at the same time.
Exactly.
So what does that client need to do to not do that?
Those clients, a lot of them need awareness, right? So what we have them do is be in some kind of like supine position. So they start to learn like where their spine is. So I'll put my hands underneath their low back, or have them put their hands underneath their low back, feel that curvature of your low back, bring their hips up again on the wall. So essentially, if you just bring the camera down again.
Sure.
So just say their feet are up against the wall. Because you want to bring awareness, because again, people, we none of us have great awareness of where our spine is until somebody helps us. So their feet may be on the wall or on the bench. So that way they keep their pelvis relatively neutral. They have a little bit of a lumbar spine curve. Their ribs are down. They're breathing in this position. And then they'll often bring their legs up one at a time without changing this position. Still have the lumbar spine curve, still long through my spine, ribs are still down, I'm breathing, because essentially this will be my catch position, or my overhead, catch position, and this will be the position that I need to be in for my overhead lifts. So they have to be able to be here first, because if they can't do this here, they're not doing it in an upright position. So this is one pattern that we would use just to kind of check, and then also train that ability to maintain that cylinder alignment, maintain that lumbar spine position, and give them sort of start that process of awareness of where their spine needs to be. Then the second position I would use is I would have them get, again, just do that hip hinge pattern against the wall with their hands on their pelvis, but then also their hands, check also have hands on the spine, make sure they feel like there's no change in their spinal position as they're doing their hip hinge motion. So they start to learn their range of motion, because most of us aren't super aware of what we do, myself included. I need other people to help me. But once somebody teaches me, like, hey, this is your end range. Your spine's still neutral. Perfect. I'm good there. But if I keep going, now I start to feel what happens to my low back. I can start to feel my spine flexing because my pelvis is no longer moving. So it's just about creating that awareness for your athlete and having them know the range of motion that they can actually work with. Because some athletes shouldn't be pulling from the floor. They need to pull from, so for me, I can't pull from the floor because I will have to compromise my lumbar spine because I don't have enough hip flexibility to get down to pull from the floor. So I have to pull from an elevated surface to protect my back, because as soon as I pull from the floor, I'm going to hurt my back, which I was like dumb and did that the other day. I was like, oh yeah, look at me. Not even take my own advice, So it's very important that you help your athlete figure out where their range of motion is, where their best neutral position is, and then be able to use that and understand what that is. Because again, if you're one-on-one, it's easy, but if you're in a group, some point you're gonna have to probably take them aside and show them actually where that position is, or really stress that in the group class and take everyone through this sort of assessment. Or show a couple different variations of someone who really gets a lot of hip flexion and is able to keep their spine neutral versus somebody that isn't. And just because, again, there'll be people on all ranges and everybody will be at their level. But if you want, in order to keep your athletes safe, you got to find that position that's appropriate for your athlete.
And what about in squatting, right? We just mm-hmm. talked about this with a hinging pattern.
Yep.
And squatting is similar, but not totally the same. What are we looking for as far as mechanics of the pelvis as someone drops into a squat as opposed to dropping into more of like a hinging down type of pattern?
Same idea. And again, I think there's a lot of different ways to do this, but I think the safest way for the majority of individuals is you always want to start out in an anterior pelvic rotation. So as you go into your anterior pelvic rotate, as you go into your squat position, the first motion, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the industry as a whole, with not the CrossFit, I'm talking more the weight training industry, strength and conditioning industry, they're like, drive the hips back, you know. But the problem with driving the hips back is if you're posterior tilted, you're driving the hips back in posterior pelvic tilt. So the first motion I cue my clients up into is the first motion you want to do is hinge. First motion's got to be a hinge because that sets you loading the glutes and it gets your lumbar spine neutral. And then you want to maintain it as long as you possibly can. And at some point, when you start running out of range of motion, then you'll start going into posterior pelvic tilt and some lumbar spine flexion, but not end range flexion, and not because you're not in end range thoracic extension. You want to have a subtle posterior pelvic tilt. So that's where the butt wing comes from, that posterior, that very rapid posterior pelvic tilt, is because the individuals very quickly run out of range of motion, and now they're in end range spinal flexion, and you never want a deep squat or lift in end range spinal flexion. You want to, if you look at your best lifters, they're not in end range spinal flexion. They're in flexion relative to neutral, which is more lordotic, but they're not end range flexion, and that's how they're able to protect their spines. It's those of us that don't have great hip mobility or the best mechanics for deep squatting that we get into end range flexion and we see the butt wink and the lumbar spine flexion. So, you know, it's coming back to all these ideas, just keep the spine as neutral as you can, train that neutral, train for hip mobility around the neutral spine, and then that your nervous system will start giving you more range to get deeper into the squat and really train the anterior pelvic rotation to keep that as far through the motion as you possibly can. Knowing that at some point, yes, you have to go into posterior pelvic rotation, but just not end range posterior pelvic rotation.
Sure. So say someone has some of these issues.
Yeah.
Right? They have impingement in the front of the hip, poor motor control of the hip and low back, all the stuff we're talking about.
Yep.
Yet they want to work out.
Yeah.
What is the line as far as, you know, should they be squatting? Should they be deadlifting? Can they do this stuff? And then, like you mentioned, do some resets afterwards to mitigate some of the potential consequences, you know, and obviously this is a case by case basis,
correct.
You know, how much people need to or want to push into these areas.
Sure.
I think something that's challenging for people is attempting to try to correct this movement dysfunction, but not just stop training altogether.
Correct. Yeah. That's always a challenge. If you're dealing with a significant injury, yeah, sometimes you just have to stop the training because you're not resting enough to allow the tissue to adapt and heal. However, like if you're in this process, just take some of these ideas in the process. I mean, like you're currently training and you're like, hey, you know what? I got some hamstring tightness. I got some hip mobility issues. Just take some of these concepts and start to incorporate them. Don't stop training. Just start to incorporate them because even these little changes, even though they seem so minute, can make a massive amount of difference in your ability. It's kind of like this. I give people this example in our courses all the time. Bend your finger back till it hurts. So everybody's finger will be at a different, you know, place where it hurts. Just unbend it enough so it doesn't hurt. Sometimes it doesn't take very much motion to make it not hurt, but that little bit of change can be just enough to take the stress off your joints or put it where you want it and make your joints healthier, happier, and give your lifts, you know, even allow you to have even more success with your lifts.
Yeah, got it. Because I think that for a lot of folks, it's a, they feel like it's whatever, the two steps forward, two steps back,
three steps forward, four steps back.
It's just kind of like an up and down type of thing.
Correct.
Where they're always kind of battling a little bit of pinching,
a little
bit of like a weird tight glute on one side.
Yeah.
And they're just always struggling to kind of get out of that loop.
And I think it's the challenge, what makes it challenging for so many of us, you know, myself included, is we've all gotten strong off this information that we've had up to date. So that's how you've set up your nervous system. And now it's like, okay, in order to retrain your nervous system, yeah, in an ideal world, you just step back and start from sort of square one, not really square one, but you just peel back a lot. The challenge is you're going to have to peel back a certain level on some of the lifts you're doing, because like I said, you're strong in the strategy that you currently have, you know? So if you're going to change the strategy, you're not going to be as strong. And you just have to allow your ego to be okay with that for a while and not just say, hey, you know what? I changed my hip strategy, so now I'm going to go back and lift the exact same weight I was just lifting. Some people can do that. You know, some great athletes will be able to do that. You know, all you have to do is release this, set their hip back up, teach them how to be here. They're golden and they're lifting the same weight. But for the majority of us, we've all gotten strong around these non-optimal strategies. So we'll have to peel back a little bit on some of the some of the work we're doing, some of the amount of weight, usually sometimes it's the amount of reps and things like that, so that you can give yourself time now to build up the new strategy and have it, you know, work cohesively together to give you the end result that you want.
Yeah, sure. What about performance? I mean, we're talking about a lot of this stuff as far as reducing impingement feelings or negative consequences from training.
Yeah, yeah.
But where does this dovetail with actually performing better, doing more reps, doing more weight, all that kind of stuff, being able to train more often?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because we were just teaching in Taiwan, and one of the trainers over there asked, you know, this stuff sounds like it's corrective exercise, but what happens when you get into performance training? And the thing I always go back to, you know, I show some pictures and videos of Olympic lifters. That's what makes them awesome at what they do. Yeah, some of them compensate, but the most awesome lifters, and I'm sure you can go through the CrossFit world and show the same thing. The most awesome lifters, they actually lift right. And that's what allows them to be awesome. Yeah, you get some people that, you know, the outliers that compensate really good. And you're like, well, that doesn't look good, but they're just awesome.
They're just doing it anyway.
But for the most part, if you take the bulk of people, you know, if you have that bell curve, you have the outliers, like everybody gets injured over here, everybody's awesome over here. The bell curve is the best lifters, the most successful lifters for longevity, for strength, for power, for endurance, they're going to do things right, mostly right. Because that's what sets you up the best for success. You know, it's kind of like if you look at finances, right? You know, if you have a strategic plan for making money, saving money, investing money appropriately, and you don't do crazy strategies, for the most part, most people on that bell curve are going to be successful over the long term. And same thing with weightlifting. If you use these strategies, again, it shouldn't be viewed as corrective exercise. It's corrective from a standpoint of if you got an issue, it's going to be corrective for you. But it's really just smart training strategies. It's how the body is designed to work. It's just that some of us have gotten out of these strategies just because of injuries and compensations and things we've been taught incorrectly.
Yeah. I think that most of the time, these optimal movements are optimal both for health of the joints as well as performance.
Exactly.
Right. It's not always the same, but it's usually pretty close.
Yeah.
And when it's not the same, it's usually kind of an edge case of like, okay, well, you know, maybe this crazy arch on your bench press isn't actually good for you, but if you are someone who's going to really compete in powerlifting and you want to make that trade-off, fine.
That's exactly right. And I use that example. I'm like, if you're a powerlifter, you better get your chest up as high as you possibly can. You know, there's none of this, you know, align everything, keep everything controlled. It's like, that's your job. Get as much weight off your chest. So that's a perfect example of like, you're pushing the limits because that's what your sport requires. And then you just take that, just understand that you're taking that risk on, right? You know, as part of the sport. But then you still need to spend time like on sort of mitigating the you know, the potential injuries you're creating by pushing the limits of your sport.
And I think that also when you are trying to perform better, one of the things you're trying to do is accumulate more quality training sessions than everyone else.
Exactly.
Right? If you can do more training at a consistent quality than the people you're competing against, that you will probably adapt better than them.
One of the best
ways to do that is to move well so that you're able to get more volume without consequences of like, oh man, I squatted too much and now my hip's bothering me.
Exactly right. It's all about consistency. It's like you said, the best lifters, they're going to be the most consistent over time, right? It's not because they have the best lifting session today. It's because they've had a great lifting session and they can do it month after month, year after year, and they're not nickel and diming, you know, with this, like a shoulder issue now, I got a hip issue now, you know. So it's like you said, two steps forward and three steps back. You know, it's like, you know, two steps forward, maybe half a step back, three steps forward, a step back. But they keep progressing forward and they're not stopping because of, you know, all these issues that come up for a lot of us.
Yeah. So if people want to try to incorporate some of these things we were talking about, what do you recommend? How often and after training sessions you mentioned, you know, sometimes people will do separate sessions that are sort of aerobic in nature, so they might have more time for movement play and all that kind of stuff. How would you typically recommend someone work on something like this consistently so that it becomes, you know, regular enough that they're going to get results from it?
I would do it as regular as possible. Just find a couple key movements like the hamstring mobility one that I demonstrated. That's you got to do that one. Almost everybody can benefit from that, unless you're that person that your leg just flies up because you actually do have, you know, over lengthened hamstrings. That's not too many athletes or coaches. use that. I would use that before, and I would even use that one after, you know, because that's a nice one just to make sure that you, because what you want to do is like, say you've created more range of motion in your posterior hip. Now you've done your hip hinge. You're like, oh, I got a pretty free hip hinge range of motion. Then at the end of your session, go back and recheck that. And that's one thing we always teach our athletes as well. Go back and check your range of motion at the end of your session. If it's good, perfect. You don't need to do anything at the end of your session because your session just reinforced everything that you just did as part of your warm-ups or your correctives. You don't need to do anything at the end, and you can work on more of that stuff on your sort of off day or your rest day. But if you're finding, and this is why it's important to recheck your range of motion at the end of your session, if you're finding that your range of motion has significantly, moderately to significantly decreased at the end of your session, you should be doing another session of a huge one, but a mobility session with control at the end of your training session. So check your range of motion at the end of your warm-ups and then at the end of your session, and it should be relatively the same. You should not have a decrease in performance at the end of your session, because that's really the sign that your body's has gotten into that protective mode. So you want to make sure you get out of that right away. And then on your off days, yeah, you can spend a little more time doing your mobility work, your stability work, your breathing, things like that. But yeah, you use range of motion before and after, after your warm-ups, and then before you leave for the day, just so you know that you've done something good for your body. You've left it in a good spot for your next training session.
Yeah, that makes sense. That the potentially reducing a bunch of that range of motion is indicative that you have stressed your system enough that it's kind of locking you up.
Correct.
Which sometimes it's going to happen. And that's not, it's not never do that.
Right. Because
yeah, and you're going to occasionally do something where, you have to do more reps than you used to.
That's right.
Yeah, and maybe you're going to fatigue and you're going to get in some bad positions.
Start a different lifting program or a new lift that you're not familiar with. Yeah, it will happen. But just know that that's what's happened so that you don't keep feeding into that pattern day after day, week after week. And before you know, you're like, damn, I'm back, never hurt before. Now the hip problem is starting to creep back in. But your range of motion will tell you that right away.
Yeah, it's at least brings some awareness for you.
Correct.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Like that one. Yeah, that one was tough because my hamstring range of motion reduced by 30 degrees from when I started to when I ended.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Question on that. What about if people feel just sort of stiff and unwarmed up,
mm-hmm.
and then after they feel much looser, and they have better range of motion just from quote unquote warming up? I mean, is that something they should take into account if they're trying to assess their range of motion on different tests?
So if they feel stiff in the beginning and then they warm up, I'm not really concerned. And then they have more range of motion. I'm not really concerned with that unless they lose it during their workout. Again, I'm going to go have them recheck it at the end of the workout. And if they're losing it during their workout, then I know that stiffness is probably something that's happening. I'm really concerned about what happens right after your workout and the next day. Like, how much is your range of motion decreasing? Not because you have muscle soreness, because if you train hard and you have muscle soreness, you're going to be stiff the next day just because of the fibers breaking down and all that. But if you're waking up the next day and the next couple of days and you're getting more stiff, and you're noticing like, I'm waking up more stiff, I'm more stiff throughout the day, that just a general overall stiffness, then you know that you're doing something to your nervous system that it's not liking. So that's more of a sign that, hey, something I'm doing, if it's global, then it's probably just a programming issue. Like you're probably just overtraining at that point. But if it's just a specific area, then you know that something about your training is affecting that area, not in a great way. So, but if people are just like, yeah, I feel a little stiff, I'm not bad, but I warm up and I feel great, that I'm not super worried about that.
Yeah. Got it. Great. What else should we know? What else is important?
I don't know. I think we really covered the gamut. I mean, those are the, like, of all the things that we discussed, like, those are the things that, like, I think that most of the industry doesn't talk about that are really key components to really maintaining hip mobility. The other thing I would say is just make sure you get soft tissue work. And regardless of all this great stuff, you're going to get beat up a little bit. It's just the nature of training and really trying to push your max. And you're going to need, like, a good, chiropractor, massage therapist, get your nutrition right. It's get your gut right. You guys all know that from working with Todd and listening to Todd. So, just know that you got to do the preventative work too, just to make sure that your body keeps functioning well and you can tolerate, the things you're putting it through.
There you go. Words of wisdom. Awesome.
Thanks, man. Yeah, appreciate you having me on.
All right, everybody. Have a good day. We can actually stop it.